missing this.
When that didn't materialise, I think both Paulie and myself probably looked at each other and kind of thought, what next?
Then get this, the all-new OTB Sports app. Off the Ball, Ireland's premier sports channel, now has a new home, featuring the biggest names in Irish and world sports. Podcasts, interviews, news, commentary, analysis, plus almost 20 years of sporting archives. All free and ready when you are, at home or on the go. The new OTB Sports app. Download it now from the App Store and Google Play.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Hi, you're very welcome back. AIB have teamed up with award-winning documentary filmmaker Ross Whittaker to tell the story of GAA's toughest summer. The series consists of 5 webisodes. You may well have seen 2 of them so far, TJ Reid last week and David Brady this week. They're available each Thursday at the AIB YouTube page, as well as a full-length feature documentary, which is set to air on RTE television at the end of next month. I'm delighted to say that Ross joins us now. Ross, good afternoon to you.
Thanks for having me.
In terms of this series, what was the attraction to it? Because you've got 11, 12 years of making different documentaries about sport. This one is very GAA focused and around GAA players. What was the attraction towards getting involved with this project in the first place?
Yeah, it's a good question. So at the beginning of the kind of COVID-19 crisis, I suppose me and any other filmmaker was probably thinking to themselves, like, what is the story that you want to tell in relation to this? Or can you even, is it possible to tell stories about this time, you know? And I was actually at home with my kids most of the time, and I was reading all the sports websites and so on and so forth. And I was noticing the way the GAA community was really coming to life. And I just thought it was amazing. And I remember thinking to myself, like, the GAA is the sporting story of this period, this COVID-19 lockdown. And literally a couple of days later, I got a call from the people behind the Toughest, which is obviously a brand that everyone knows for many years in GAA filmmaking, I suppose. And they said they were interested in maybe trying to do something around this time, the toughest summer. And it just felt like the stars aligned. And that was a story that I was really interested in trying to tell. So from then on, we started discussing it, working up treatments, all the things that you do. And you know, it was green lit and we were underway. So that's what I've been doing now for the last few months.
Having seen the first 2 episodes, very clearly you've gone for the human side to the story here. In the case of TJ Reid, him creating effectively web workouts and getting children involved and getting interested in sport. And in the case of David Brady, trying to keep that connection with supporters. I would imagine that kind of human side to the story had to be a big attraction towards the project too.
Yeah, well, there was no sport. So what do you do when there's no sport, if that's your life? And I think what we were trying to do really is you're trying to show how people were impacted by, say, lockdown, and then how they responded to it. What we saw all across Ireland was the incredible network of the GAA and all of the things that people were doing to try and help their communities. So that was just naturally the place to go, is to shine a light on this sport that's obviously quite unlike any other in terms of its network, you know, and in terms of how embedded it is in its communities. So that was it. That was the human story of it. And that was what made, I think, the GAA's story quite unique.
You kind of summed up in one of the first shots in the TJ Reid piece, the feeling that probably a lot of GAA supporters had going into this year. And that was that maybe the gates wouldn't open. You kind of open with that locked gate on Ballyhale just before we get to meet TJ.
Yeah, well, that you're kind of starting out something like this. You say, where do you start? And you say, well, you know, at some point these gates are going to be open, so you better go and film loads of them that are locked. And look, I'm actually not a member of a GAA club, and I only played a few matches ever in my life, but still, you know, have followed it and been a fan of it. But when we were traveling around the country and starting to gather stories, I would put in my phone in Google Maps, I'd be like, GAA club, because I'd be like, where's the next GAA club that we can go and get some shots of? And you seem to be basically like 5 to 10 minutes from a GAA club, no matter where you are in Ireland. And all of them, you're passing them and they're locked and they're empty. And it is kind of eerie. And as you do that, you start to realize that there's this incredible network and world that is absolutely asleep at the moment. And that's what it was like when we started. And obviously now it's coming to life again, so which is a wonderful thing for us, you know, because we've seen both sides of that coin. But going around the country then talking to people, you realize, as TJ says, you know, that the GAA is the heartbeat of so many communities. And, you know, those same people that are volunteers in the club are the people, are among the people that are doing huge things in their own communities to try and make sure that people are okay, you know, and whether it's deliveries or turf cutting or putting flags up to kind of support frontline workers, those people are out there. And I don't think we've seen that really in any of the sports, certainly not in the same kind of concerted fashion.
And as a visual, there's something tremendously beautiful about an empty GAA stadium. Lots of kind of drone footage of Nolan Park and of Ballyhale that we saw in the first piece, and we got to see a bit of Ballina in the second one. Was there something nice about, you know, shooting them? There's something very picturesque, I think, about an open and empty stadium.
Yeah, and, you know, like, I suppose juxtaposition is at the heart of what you try to do in storytelling and in, like, trying to create a narrative that feels cinematic is, you know, and to be able to compare an empty pitch with what it should be like, or to use sounds from what's normally a packed pitch or a packed stadium with the empty shots is kind of like a really attractive proposition for a filmmaker to be able to play with, I suppose, you know. So, yeah, I mean, and there is something really evocative about places that should be full being empty. And that's something. Now, at the same time, you wouldn't want to watch an hour of that, let's be honest. So thankfully, it has come back to life, you know, and thankfully we are seeing that transition, all of those transitions, you know, getting back to training. And I think that people have been a little bit, you know, somewhat kind of overwhelmed by that feeling of being back out on the pitch with your mates and even seeing, you know, maybe some of the older members of the community just coming down to watch training. I mean, TJ always references that, for example, you know, the some of the lads are down to watch us, you know, and even that's something that's a little bit of a release for people, even if they're not playing, to just come down and watch training and say hello to someone. So it's a great thing in the course of this that we have seen it come back to life, and hopefully that will continue and go from that process of having empty pitches to seeing them fill up again. And I know we're not filling up stadiums yet, but hopefully we'll get there in the not too distant future.
We get to meet TJ Reid then with a hurl in his hand, which perhaps feels appropriate when he's on the training field. And he pops one over effectively from halfway straight over the bar. Now, TJ Reid, one of the best players, possibly the best player of his generation. I'm not going to doubt that he made that first take.
Absolutely. Of course he did. Yeah.
There is something beautiful though about filming, and obviously you've been drawn to, you know, sport as a way of telling stories previously with the documentaries you've done, but I think there is something quite beautiful about hurling and that footage that you get of TJ just poking around, and there's a very obviously cinematic feel about it too.
Yeah, there really is, and TJ is not the only one that you'll see with a hurl in his hand over the course of them, and like his, you know, we use some footage in the short. TJ will also appear in the longer piece, but there'll be quite different elements that you might find in that. So, you know, he's a guy that still is involved in the family farm, and the shots of him pucking the ball against the wall or against a big barn on his family's farm, you know, and that's literally what he's been doing probably since the age of 4 or 5. So, like, yeah, it's an amazing visual. And look, that's been happening all over the country, from TJ to down in Ballyhaunas. We've been filming down there, and you have, like, the kids in their back gardens poking it against those walls. And, like, that's just something that people have been doing to improve their skills but also pass the time. And as you say, it is a lovely visual. Again, it's a juxtaposition, isn't it? Like, people training on their own, you know. It's kind of, I know that anyone that's obsessed with sport will always kind of build their skills on their own, but, like, to be sort of forced to do that is a very unusual thing. You know, probably is a place that involves a lot of thinking time and a certain type of loneliness, I suppose, you know what I mean? But I think what we've seen with all of those people is that they have tremendous resilience as well, you know, and that, yeah, this few months. And I suppose the thing to remember, and something that we hope to bring to life, is, you know, we didn't really know how long it was going to last. We can now look at it in the rearview mirror and think, you know, that was only, you know, 12 weeks essentially was the main part of it. So, you know, oh God, you think you should be able to survive 12 weeks. But when you're in the middle of it, it doesn't feel like that. You know, and I suppose that's something that by filming during the time, we've been able to capture a little bit of as well.
And even when it comes to that kind of challenge of COVID-19, we obviously see the challenge with TJ trying to keep his business going and not being able to open the gym. As a filmmaker and making this series, did COVID-19 and social isolation and all those kind of different challenges, did they actually make it more difficult to make a series like this?
Yeah, it's way harder, actually. You know, I mean, you soon realize, I suppose, that there's certain things you can do to make it not too different from what you would normally do. Like, we film all the interviews outside, or we film them in large spaces where we can be 2 meters, everyone's 2 meters away from each other. We've the minimum possible amount of people in the vicinity. The cameraman sets up the camera, and then he takes his monitor away, so that, because I would be, as an interviewer, right beside the camera. So he goes off with his monitor and he watches the focus and so on separately. So there's all these little things, a little bit of extra kind of setup time, thinking time that goes into it. But before too long, you realize it's still possible, you know, and obviously we didn't do anything before we were allowed to either. So, you know, that's an important point. But yeah, it makes it a little bit harder. It reduces the choices you have in terms of how you can do things. But the other side of it is that ultimately you're trying to capture something that feels like it was of a particular time. And, you know, whether people are watching it now or maybe looking back at it in future years to get a taste of what it was like at the time, hopefully they'll be able to recognize, like, oh, well, those choices were made for that reason. You know, obviously we didn't film them in dressing rooms because you couldn't. There was no one in the dressing rooms, you know. So it becomes a function of what you're doing, I suppose. And then on the other side of it, even like, you know, I'm here in a room of my own, the editor's in another room on his own. If we want to show the cut to some of the people that are involved, they're off. Some of them are sitting in their cars, which is quite funny. Or they could be sitting, you know, the six-year-old walks through the back of their Zoom call as they're chatting. So, like, all those little things, they do make it an unusual experience. Ultimately, I think we've been able to still pretty much do what we want at the level we want to do it, but it's definitely more challenging.
When you were making the treatment for this and doing the plan, did you ever consider trying to draw the series out a little bit until games are back happening again? Or was that even part of the story that you're trying to tell here?
Well, the original treatment, and, you know, this would involve Rothko as well, who are the agency behind The Toughest, all these things happen in conversation, and of course AIB by extension. You know, the when we were doing it, it was like, and hopefully we will just at least see somebody go back training. You know, at least if we could finish with a shot of someone running back out onto a pitch, at least we'll feel like we've got to the end of a narrative that has shown life without sport and the return to it. So honestly, the way it's panned out probably couldn't have been better, you know, to sort of be able to see time go back to training. And now we're back in matches and, you know, we're following about 9 or 10 people over the course of this, and over last weekend, this weekend and the following weekend, everyone will have their first match. And ultimately, that's where the film is going to take you to, you know, that experience of reverting to being a competitive animal, of being there with your teammates, of having the joy of victory and the disappointment of defeat. Those are all the things that make the games exciting to all of us. And, you know, GAA is about, it is all those other things that we've spoken about, but ultimately it's about playing games and being out there on the pitch. So to be able to return to that within the time frame of when we're making this has been brilliant. And should we extend it further? I mean, it's something that obviously has been discussed, but I think this feels like the natural conclusion of the story we're telling, to see people back out playing, having not been able to do so for so long.
When it came to the selection process of these 9 or 10 athletes that you're picking to follow, did you know about them beforehand and have a firm idea about who you wanted to speak to? Or how did the final decision come on the people you were going to speak to?
Yeah, well, the funny thing was that before I even knew this was going to happen, I'd already started creating a folder of GAA stories around the lockdown, you know, because even within the first couple of weeks, there was really interesting stuff happening. You know, people like Dave Brady making phone calls, TJ doing the videos, and he wasn't the only one, obviously, like there was Kieran Kilkenny and other people as well. So this was something, I mean, the phone calls thing was the first thing that just really blew me away. You know, it was that it wasn't even like that there was one or two, you know, it started with one or two, but before long, you know, I think there was tens, if not hundreds, of GAA stars, past and present, picking up the phone and ringing people. And I know, talking to Dave Brady, that, like, he did it on day one, but and people will have seen, you know, the video by now, hopefully, but, you know, he did it on day one, but he's been doing pretty much three phone calls a day since the beginning of April. And I mean, he's obviously a man that is a great communicator and loves to talk and loves to find out people's stories. So, you know, he's sort of like the perfect character to be doing that kind of thing. But ultimately, like, he can see that people are getting so much from it and that he's getting something from it. And David actually said a really interesting thing to me, I think, which is, you know, all the years I played and even up till quite recently, I felt like GAA was what happened between the lines. And the last few months, I've decided it's what happens outside the lines. That's what it is, you know. And for people who don't play at an elite level, maybe they already knew that. But I think that's something that we've definitely seen in that time. So, you know, stories like that you were on the lookout for. You know, I wanted a story about someone making phone calls. You know, you want a story about people that have gone online and created maybe videos for young people to improve their skills. And like, as a parent of young children, obviously, I know any distraction is great for your kids for an hour in the day as well. So, like, those kinds of stories you're looking at, stories of like, well, we really want, you know, we've heard these stories of people that are delivering food to elderly people or people who need it, but they're wearing the GAA jerseys because they know immediately. And I mean, I first heard about that in Dingle, actually, but they're wearing the shirts because they know the people will trust them because they're from the local club, and that will be a designator of that, you know, people delivering prescriptions. There was a story came out about people cutting turf, you know, helping with that, wearing again their jerseys, you know, to show that solidarity. So, you know, you start seeing these stories emerge and you start making a list of the kinds of things that you want. And then once you start getting into production, you go out and seek them and hope that people will be happy to participate, which largely people were, I think, because they really got what we were trying to do.
That feels like something that's kind of unique to the GAA in many ways too, in that there's a connection to the community, particularly when you're talking about clubs and club people during some of these, that maybe isn't there when it comes to professional sport, that in many ways they're seen as genuinely being representatives of the area that they're from.
Yeah, and like, we're talking a lot about TJ, I suppose, but he's such a great example of that, and that would also extend to someone like Katrina Cormacan down in Capitago, who's the next video coming up, and several other of the people, you know, that we filmed with. It's, if you think of, you know, I hate comparing sports and I'm not going to, but I just think that it seems to me, and again, you know, I came from this one a little bit outside, but like observing it, is someone like TJ has remained absolutely part of his community, you know, and absolutely part of his club. And when he talks about Ballyhale or when you're down there in the club with him, like, it's so much a part of him. And it's absolutely normal for him to be there, and everyone else, you know, doesn't treat him any differently. It's not like he's, as you say, maybe the best hurler of his generation. Like, to think if that was any other sport, would you still be, you know, living in your hometown, looking after your cows, lining up with the lads, loving it, you know, going training and hanging around after training to do a bit of extra because you've got a big club match coming up. You know, it feels completely unique and special, and something that we have here maybe that you don't see in a lot of other countries and you don't see in other sports to the same extent.
Is David Brady almost the dream to work to? I would imagine that if you're working with David Brady, the biggest challenge is trying to get this inside, whatever, getting inside an hour, to try and get inside a few minutes for a little web series. It must be almost impossible to encapsulate David Brady in that short period of time.
I don't know what you mean at all. look, he's obviously like a really skilled communicator, and he's very happy to be in a filming environment, and he's got a lot to say. So yeah, I mean, he's a dream from that point of view. I mean, the way he holds himself and stuff like that, you almost think like in another life maybe he would have been an actor or something. You know, he just seems to have a natural affinity for the camera, and I think he, you know, without being over the top about it, I think he enjoys the process. So yeah, he's an absolutely great person, and like, hopefully people are enjoying the video that's out this week, because I think he's, as well as all those things, a really genuine guy and really means and believes in what he's doing and really believes in the GAA, you know. So he's absolutely, you know, from our point of view, a great character to have, and I think, you know, people will respond to his authenticity and feel the emotion of the film that he's involved in.
Yeah, because then we've got this kind of lovely echo between the first episode and the second episode, because we get to see the children who've sent the videos to TJ Reid and the pictures of them taking part in the different sessions as he's showing them how to train. And then we get to see David Brady, and it's an older generation that David Brady's appealing to and trying to be nice to within these horrible times. There is that kind of lovely thing between kids in the first one and older people in the second one.
Yeah, and I think what we're trying to do across the five videos is not have them all feel like they're a certain type of thing, you know. But what they're all about is, if you were to summarize it, is, you know, we were met by this challenge collectively, and here's how it impacted this individual to make them maybe struggle a little bit or question a little bit of their own life, and here's how they responded. And that's kind of across the board. And you know, next week is Katrina Cormack, an All-Ireland winner in Camogie. And then the fourth episode, you know, is an elderly gentleman, Padraig McMahona, who runs a sweet shop in Cusack Park. And it's unbelievably emotional story. And then in the fifth one, actually, I won't say too much about the fifth one at the moment in case it changes. But the you know, each of them is coming from a slightly different angle within the same world, you know. And I think that hopefully what we're trying to do is give people, through all of these different kind of stories, an overview of the GAA at this time and how people responded, and try to just reflect what all of us have seen, if we're paying any attention to what's been happening.
In case it changes, obviously implies that you're still in the edit process of that last one then.
Oh, I'm still in the edit process of the fourth one. So, you know, the hour long, we're in the edit for that as well. So look, we're doing this on a pretty quick turnaround. You know, it's not so long ago that we were going into lockdown and so on and so forth. So it's pretty intense to make. But ultimately, I think we're getting everything we need and everything we want. And if, in a funny way, like, I'm glad, because I think that people will watch these films now, and then maybe in a few months' time, you know, they'll have moved on from what we've experienced, hopefully, you know. And then in a couple of years' time, people might want to look back at this time again. You know, I think there's that kind of, those windows of interest. And I think being able to kind of capture these stories now as they're happening and present them pretty quickly, I think is a way of allowing us to kind of reflect on what we're going through while we're still going through it.
And in many ways, as you say, in the future, these are going to be a YouTube snapshot in time. They're going to be very much of their time.
I really hope so. You know, I really hope the shorts, but also the hour long, will be something that is an archive of the present. You know, you don't often think of it when you're making something in the present tense, because you think of archive as being something from the past. But anytime you're making a contemporary story, you're creating an archive for people to look back at. And I think that's kind of a big responsibility in a funny way, you know. So you want people to be able to look back, and they'll have the news, and you know what I mean, there's all these things that will be there. And I know that there's all sorts of archives, I'm sure, being created by different entities in Ireland. But like, hopefully this will be something of the archive of GAA at the time.
Is it difficult when you go out to film when you've got two different projects in mind at the one time? I'm sure you're thinking about the overall 1 hour, everything fitting together nicely, and you're still mindful that you probably want to get some nice stuff that's going to fit well into a 2 to 3 minute piece. Is that a challenge in and of itself, to try and get both down together?
Yeah, and try to do five of them at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a challenge, you know, but like, you just try and do as much work as you can on paper, and you kind of have a sense of, okay, where is this story going to fit into this hour-long film? But also, what are the elements that you require that will take place in a 2 to 3 minute film? Like, so you kind of, you write out both. And I think the hour-long is much more difficult in a way. You know, you're trying to interweave 9 or 10 stories through a 50-minute documentary and make sure that you don't lose any of the characters at any point too, you know. I mean, ultimately these kinds of films, when they go out on television, they take place in three parts: part one, part two, part three. And you want each of your characters to have something to say in each of those parts. So you start thinking about it almost quite technically, I suppose. You start thinking about, okay, well, what will David Brady be doing when Padraig McMahona is doing this, and who might follow on from the other? And then, you know, you have editors too, who are, this is meat and drink to them, all these kinds of stories. So that's a conversation we'd be having with Derek Holland and Wongus Dinsmore, who are the two editors on the piece. So we separated the edits into the short films and the long form. So that as well gives you someone that's thinking only about one of each. I think that helps a lot. And I think that's something we thought would be really important from the beginning, is that even if my head is a mess, that at least there's someone else there that's kind of separating out those two projects and kind of working on them solely.
When someone goes to check out your IMDb and they go back over the last decade or so, they're going to see sport consistently and at least one sport piece every couple of years, whether that's Ali coming to Ireland, whether that's rugby with Munster, whether that's Jack Charlton, whether that's this piece with AIB. What is it about sport that keeps on drawing you back to it as a subject?
I just got typecast, basically. No, it's, look, I mean, what do you want as a filmmaker? You want compelling characters. That's really important. But one of the things that you really want is a great story. And what sport often gives you, you know, certainly the ones that get made into documentaries, are really what feel like really high stakes, you know. And certainly we always, like, it's funny, you know, and surely on Off the Ball, or whether it's on Sky Sports, you know, you hear a commentator say, well, the stakes can't be bigger than this, you know, about whatever upcoming match there is. But if we all step back for a second, we realize in the grand scheme, the stakes are high in a sporting context, but not necessarily in a life context. But we get so drawn into it and we love it so much that those stakes feel very, very high. And then with a great sports story, you have the sporting stakes, but then you have the personal stakes, you know, story of that person's life. And when you can bring those two things together, it allows you to create a type of drama that is not impossible to see elsewhere, but it's hard to kind of sort of weave into a story elsewhere, because sport allows us, much like I've just said, in terms of how we talk about it, to be more bombastic, I suppose, than we can be about normal life. Like we would never go up to, you know, sit down with a friend to talk about some problem they have and say, well, the stakes have never been higher than this. You know, you just can't do that. So sport allows you to invest the level of kind of drama into something that is very difficult to do in real life. And then if there are also real life stakes within story, then it allows you to make something that feels very strong to the viewer if they're interested, you know. So that's very enticing to me. I think we've seen some, not mine necessarily, but like, you know, the OJ Made in America film, the Michael Jordan films, you know, and many, many others, you know, Andre the Giant, like just incredible human stories told through a sporting filter that are probably amongst some of the best factual stuff that's been made in the last 10 years. So obviously I'm not the only one that feels that way. And I think, yeah, there's something special about how sport allows you to enter into a story, I suppose, that's very enticing, as I said. But I am interested, if anyone's out there with projects, in doing non-sporting stories too. So just keep that in mind.
Just as you mentioned Michael Jordan, we obviously think about The Last Dance and the huge success it was for ESPN and for Netflix. And again, a series that was affected by COVID, because this was due to come out weeks later when the basketball season was over. There's a slot that just empties up on ESPN because they've got no live basketball to show. This series is rushed forward and brought out, becomes a huge critical success and a huge commercial success too, both for ESPN and Netflix. If you are going to be making sport documentaries, I would imagine the success of The Last Dance is probably good news for sport filmmakers in the general sense.
I think so. But I think that, like, the factual world or the documentary world is going through a great time, you know, and it's not just sports, even though, I mean, the kind of corollary of sporting films is that the rights to action is so expensive, you know, and obviously certain deals have been cut over the years. I don't know what the background is to The Last Dance. The OJ film wasn't so much about sport, but there was plenty of sport in his early days. I think for Senna, they cut some amazing deal to have Formula One. But if they'd actually paid the race car prices, I don't think you could even afford to make that film. So that's sometimes the difficulties of sport as well, is that the rights are so valued that they become very expensive. We've seen so many other great documentaries coming out on Netflix or Amazon or wherever. So I just think it's a golden era of kind of factual films and documentary films. I think those streaming platforms have recognize that when we get sit down at home, we are as interested in watching a documentary as we are watching a drama film or a drama series, and have invested more money in it. And that's really what you see with film like The Last Dance or other projects like, you know, Don't F with Cats, for which Irish editor Michael Hart just won a BAFTA, which was amazing. You know, you just look at them and the production value is so high. And you think that, you know, it required a leap for the likes of Netflix, or same for, you know, HBOs and whatever, to recognize that when you do these at a high level, people will love them just as much as they love a drama series.
You made a Katie Taylor documentary a couple of years ago. I'm sure you'd probably love to be following her right now, given that she's about to take on Delphine Persoon in the back garden of Eddie Hearn. On the face of it, that's a magnificent story to tell. Is she ever, given that even since your documentary finished, she's now the undisputed lightweight champion and defending her belts, would you love to go back and maybe reinvestigate her story as it's progressed since?
Absolutely. And we've talked about it. And at one point we said we were going to do it. But, you know, it's funny. I think when we started the process of making that documentary, I was really the only one with a camera in Katie's dress. You know, Katie's very, I suppose, open to me. You know, I think she wouldn't even mind if I filmed in her dressing room at the next flight, even though, you know, I don't know if I'm prepared to quarantine for 2 weeks while I have still this to do. But I think the difficulty, as she's gone through her professional career, the demands on her time and everything have become so much greater that it would be trickier purely from a time standpoint and a distraction standpoint to have someone like me involved in the way that I was. And it's kind of a shame in one way, but in another way, I think we made the documentary at exactly the right time. I think that it had its own narrative arc. It finishes when she wins her world title, you know, having started just after the Olympics in 2016 when she was at her lowest ebb. So kind of piling on top of that, I don't know if extending that documentary any further would have made sense. But sure, like, I mean, I love Katie. I think she's an amazing person, amazing character. There's always interesting stuff going on behind the scenes that I may hear about that people wouldn't even have heard about, you know what I mean? And just little micro dramas of what it is to be at high level sport. Yeah, the Delphine story is fascinating. You'd love to be there. I actually said I would go before all this happened. So yeah, I think it's her story is a great story and just keeps going on, and hopefully she'll win this fight. I mean, that's, you know, that's going to be a really tough one. I feel like we made a film that did her justice, and that people will still be able to enjoy no matter what happens in her career.
Yeah, because I mentioned obviously hurling must be fun to shoot just from a cinematography point of view. Boxing, given particularly the rich heritage of boxing on film, must also be a lot of fun to actually make a documentary about.
Yeah, boxing is kind of the zenith, I think, of sports filming, because there's a few reasons. Well, one of them is they don't box all that often. You know, if you're watching Sunderland Till I Die or even The Last Dance, they just seem to be constantly playing matches. You know what I mean? It's absolutely constant. It's like, how do you build drama in a situation where, like, they could be at their lowest ebb on a Saturday and then, you know, to use a sporting term, cock a hoop on a Wednesday, you know? So it's very hard to, I think, in those sports where you play 60 matches a year, to kind of work with the drama of what's happening without it just constantly being up and down and so on and so forth. Whereas with boxing, you know, they only fight 3 or 4 times a year. The stakes, to use that term, of every fight, is actually huge. You know, if you lose one fight as a professional boxer, that could be it. You know, and also the physical damage that can potentially happen. Whereas, as I say, you know, a football team, a hurling team, soccer team, you can lose one game, and unless it's sort of towards the end of the season, you can come back the next week and hopefully make up for it. So boxing, I think that's a big thing in boxing. And it's also access to it can be interesting in terms of, usually there's someone like Eddie Hearn or whoever that really holds all the cards in terms of the sports, and he can kind of, you know, if Eddie is okay with you filming behind the scenes in an event, and with the help of someone like Sky or RTE or whoever is the broadcaster, you don't have as many hoops to jump through. So boxing is kind of a really interesting one. to make films about. But I think it's mostly because the stakes of every single fight is huge, and also that the rewards are potentially huge. And a lot of people in boxing clubs are coming from more socially deprived areas in a lot of cases, and winning a world title is like winning the lottery. So the stakes in their lives are huge as well. So I think that's why boxing is so attractive to filmmakers.
You mentioned authentic when you talk about David Brady. I think when it comes to boxing, you get that authenticity as well, because they're kind of a single athlete in many ways. I know they have their team and they have their trainers, but ultimately they're their own hype machine, because what they say is going to sell the next fight that they go into. Plus, I think there is that honesty that's maybe not there with some of the media training that you get in professional team sports. Generally, with a boxer, you tend to get honesty.
Yeah, and I think you hit on a really important thing as well, just that it's an individual sport and it all falls to that one person. And Katie would have often said that I'm under no illusions. I know everything about this, whether it's sponsorships or whether it's a documentary or whether it's, you know, the future of my manager or coach or whatever it might be, all falls to me in the ring. And the pressure of that is massive as well. And yeah, I don't know so much about the media training side of things. Yeah, it's a funny one. I hadn't really thought too much about that, actually. You can zone in on one person, focus in on one person and really get to know them. Whereas with a team, I mean, as much as you'd love to be been filming, you know, Kilkenny a few years ago, and like that's never going to happen, obviously, but you'd love to be one of those super teams, whether it's Dublin now or you know, an emerging Kerry in football. It's much harder in a team context to kind of focus in on characters, and if you do, why that person? Whereas with an individual sport, I think it's stronger to just see the stakes of that one person. If that answers your question.
Yeah,
I hadn't really thought about that one that much.
Do you enjoy working to tight deadlines as well, Ross? Because I'm thinking of last year, Shane Lowry in the Open. You had to turn that documentary around very, very quickly. I'm guessing you probably went down to Clara, spoke to his family, got whatever footage you could get and mashed it together as quickly as you possibly could. That must have been a monster to try and get that edited and ready in the time that you did it in.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And so is this. No, I don't like working to tight deadlines at all. So, but you have to do it, you know, and I think that with certain types of stories, there's a right moment for them. And if that happens to be straight away, then that's what you do. And what's wonderful sometimes, you know, say even with Katie, we wanted to get it turned around pretty quickly, but we had time in the edit, and you over time can refine things and sit back and look at them. But actually there's something about the manic energy of the quick turnaround that sometimes leads to inspiration. And, you know, a lot of the time these projects, they don't require to be poured over and over and over and over, because you can kind of sometimes lose the magic of something by overanalyzing it. And you have to remember that when you watch it for the first time, if you feel something, then by re-editing it, you know, you're in danger of losing that. And one of the things that we always say is that when you watch something for the first time, try and remember how you felt, because when you watch it the second time, it's not going to be the same. And by the time you watch it the 10th time, you're going to hate it. Yeah. You know, and every moment in it that you thought was funny is no longer funny. And every moment in it that you thought was moving is no longer moving. And then you start to second guess everything. So sometimes you're better off, you know, delivering something, seeing how you feel, and then not tinkering with it too much. And when you're on a tight deadline, you've no choice anyway. So it's a nice thing to kind of use that manic energy to just try and get there. And then that's it. It goes out to the public and hopefully they like it.
When it comes to the Larrys, I'd imagine that was just fun to shoot in a general sense too, because you've got Granny Scanlon, who's this great character. You've got Shane's dad, who was a success in his own right as an All-Ireland winner with the Offaly football team. Shane Lowry, probably one of the most honest and beloved sports people within the country. They're fun interviews to do, I would think.
It was great fun, yeah. They're amazing, you know, amazing people. You can't but love them. And some surprise as well. Like I didn't know if Wendy would do an interview. She'd never done an interview before. Mm-hmm. At least that's what she told me. And I think we ended up doing probably like a 2-hour interview with her, you know, and that's Shane's wife, Wendy. And, you know, she kind of stole the show, and I just was not expecting it, because up until then I thought that maybe she was a little shy. We weren't sure if she was going to do it, and then you interview her and she's hilarious and she's brilliant, you know. And the same with Shane's mum, you know, because you know, coming into the interview, she was a little bit, oh, I don't know, guys, you know. And next thing, you know, she has some of the killer lines of the film, and you see that definitely Shane's sense of humor came from both his mum and his dad. And his dad is such an emotional guy, like so unexpected that he would just be such a big emotional bear of a man, you know. So it was great fun. And I often still think back to moments in those interviews, actually, like in particular, like, you know, this is, by the way, obviously, it kind of came and went without much comment, but like it was the anniversary of Shane winning the Open last week, you know, and I just thought it was such an incredible, I was up there, which is where I got the idea to do the doc. I just thought it was such an incredible thing for an Irishman to win the Open on Irish soil. I don't even know if we fully got our head around how incredible a thing that was. But there's a moment in the documentary where Shane, it's the Saturday night before the Sunday morning, and he goes up to Tommy Fleetwood in the locker room and says, you know, well, I really hope one of us does it. And then the next thing he says in the interview is, of course I meant me. <You know? laughs> I just think it's hilarious. He has this like sense of humor where he kind of like drops a line and then there's always another one to come. You know, it's like the punchline kind of comes after the initial thought. But yeah, there's so many times where we were laughing making that, and they were so generous, you know. And I think Conor Ridge and Brian and his team, they really recognized that it was worthwhile to try and capture this while they were all feeling it, because even a year later we've kind of all moved on so much, you know. And so it was great that they recognized that, and they allowed us to film those interviews and to kind of capture how everyone felt at that moment. And hopefully they'll have it then again to look back at in future years. Hopefully he'll win a few more of them, but there's nothing like your first win, I'm sure.
When it comes to capturing that moment, you know, Boys in Green, people will have seen it back on TV 3 weeks ago after Jack Charlton's passing. In many ways, that kind of captures the mood of a nation as well, doesn't it? When you think about it, the great joy, the excitement. My, at least, memory and take from the early 90s were people getting interested in association football probably for the first time because the Irish football team were doing well. I think that comes across in the piece. I think a lot of the tributes to Jack Charlton said that too, that in many ways, the greatest thing Jack Charlton did was getting people interested in football that maybe weren't interested in football before.
Yeah, it's so interesting the way I've been reflecting on that quite a bit around the Boys in Green, because it was the number one sport in Ireland, both from a numbers point of view and sort of from an emotional point of view. Do you know, it was really, we hung on those games, you know, and I feel like that moment has definitely passed, you know, and as someone from Dublin, I feel like we've seen in the last 10 to 15 years is the way the GAA has become such a massive part of this city. And I could be wrong because I'm not 100% an expert in this, but it feels like it's grown so much in Dublin over the last 10 to 15 years and really kind of captured people's imagination and captured the community. And I think that, you know, so many people are now bringing their young kids down to the local GAA club where they hadn't before. And it's really interesting to see the way that has happened over time. And I certainly think, like, And rugby, obviously, as well. You know, we've seen with Leinster and so on, the incredible machine that is, both from a playing point of view, but a spectator point of view. And football or soccer has really kind of fallen down the food chain. So that was one of the things about it, was like to try and transport people back to that time and to remember how significant it was and how significant Jack was. And he finished up in such a disappointing way that I felt like that was a lot of the time the memory we had of him. Mm-hmm. You know, was maybe the guy that stayed on too long. And I don't think he did actually stay on too long myself, but he certainly, his best days for Ireland were firmly behind him at that stage. But my God, what days they were when we were having them, you know. And I think being able to put people back in those moments, it really felt like people responded to that so well, that they were so... there was so much, I suppose, nostalgia that people had, and hopefully there were a few bits in there as well that were new to people in some of the stories and so on. But like, people were really transported back to it, and I'm doing another project separately, hopefully after this, that is kind of set in the late 80s and early 90s, and it just feels like a universe away, you know. So it's a really interesting place to go back to that isn't even that many years ago, but feels like a completely different country. And that was a big attraction, I suppose, of the Boys in Green, was being able to transport us back there and to kind of feel what it was like to live in those days.
Yeah, because we obviously spoke to a lot of people about Jack Charlton over the last few weeks, and it's funny how everyone we spoke to has a memory. They know where they were when Paddy Bonner saves the penalty, or when Dave O'Leary goes back to reset the ball before the penalty, or where they were when Ray Houghton scored in 94 at Giants Stadium. These are the kind of collective memories I think that a lot of people have at a time which was very difficult for the country, but sport seemed to be a wonderful distraction for everybody at the time.
Yeah, my big one is being in the bathroom for Ray Houghton's goal against Italy in the US, which my friend Chris was having great fun with, because he's like, oh, I see you're talking about the boys in green again. And you weren't even there. You were in the toilet in my house when the goal was scored. So, yeah, I think everyone remembers. And like a big one that I always remember is when we were playing Northern Ireland up in Belfast, and you know, there was obviously the stuff with Billy Bingham and so on, and just how tense that was. And you draw on those things, you know, when you're making something like that, is you try and draw on the memories that you have yourself or memories other people have, because you don't want to sugarcoat things, and you want whatever you kind of bring to the documentary to feel like an authentic thing, and that you aren't kind of, like, the worst thing you can do is feel like you're sentimentalizing something, even if we hold it in great esteem and the nostalgia is great, or that you're overemphasizing, you know, the difficulties of a particular thing. So you draw on those memories, actually, and you go like, well, I remember feeling like that. You check it with some other people. And that, in a way, tries to give you an emotional roadmap for what the film, what the series should be. And of course, that's in, you know, conjunction with the editors, John Murphy's when the editor's on it, and Wongas again. And you're kind of having those conversations, and it feels like you're kind of talking about old days, but actually part of what you're doing is going like, okay, I feel like this about this moment. What do you think? You know, do you think, you know, is that a false memory, or can we sort of corroborate that through a few people to say, like, you know, what was the general sense of how people felt? Because you don't want to be creating kind of an archive of a time and then for it to be false, I suppose.
Yeah, and I guess to have that kind of genuine memory of things, you can't block out things like the Egypt draw or the game against Norway in 94, which were absolute rotters that people kind of very quickly forget when they go, oh yeah, but we beat Italy 1-0.
Yeah, well, one thing that did come out from the Jack Charlton tributes was, you know, a lot of people with a slight bit of discomfort, you know, had to just say, well, the football wasn't always brilliant, yeah, but they were brilliant times, you know, and some was dreadful, but, you know, I don't think people, it was such a tricky one, you know, and I think there were some terrible games, obviously, but overall, I think the story is about how we experienced it as a nation, not really about the intricacies of specific games. And of course, like, to some people, that's what it is about, you know, they're into like the specifics of games, but really, why do we remember that era? Why is it special to us? You know, it's not because of a particular moment in a particular game, you know, other than the obvious ones, but it's really about how we felt as a nation and how people came together and so on. And I think that's what gives us the lasting memory of it.
Ross, when it comes to the toughest summer in terms of work, are you thankful that a project like this comes around? Because we had Peter Coogan on a few weeks ago, and we heard from Jamie Dornan. They both had projects which they were just about to start. In the case of Jamie Dornan, he just moved his family to New York and started filming on something that was meant to be 5 to 6 months long. And next thing, everything goes into lockdown because of COVID-19. Are you thankful when a project like this comes around in the middle of such an uncertain period for the entertainment industry in a wider sense?
Yeah, well, I think we're probably a little bit luckier in the factual or documentary world in that actually there are quite a few things happening compared to the drama world of Jamie or Peter, who actually literally walked past the front of the building today, fully enough. But so I think it isn't really the same in the factual and documentary world compared to the drama world. But look, really what you're always looking out for and what you're always interested in doing is something that you feel is enjoyable but also like really relevant, and when you're doing a documentary about Shane Lowry, you just think like that's really relevant story for a few reasons, you know, the sporting context, including his family, you know, the fact that he didn't come from a golfing family but had this incredible unique talent, and what he has done in such an inspiring way at exactly the right moment. And you know, you can go through hopefully most of the things I've done and kind of have those reference points. So this documentary, the reason you're happiest that it came around is that you just think it's a brilliant thing to be able to work on, and that this is a story that really deserves to be told, and if it isn't told now, probably won't be properly told, you know. And I know I'm not the only one. There's lots of things that people are doing that are around COVID-19 and the lockdown, and particularly how people have responded to it. But it's nice to be able to tell part of the story at such an important time.
Well, you've got about a month to get the final documentary piece ready for the 1 hour, and whatever about the bit of work that might be needed on episode 4 and on episode 5. You mentioned that you've got kind of an idea for your next project after that. What's next for you then after this, without giving everything away?
I can't give anything away, I'm afraid. I don't want to jinx it as much as anything, but yeah, I mean, I suppose I'm always on the lookout for those good stories. I've become a little bit, after The Boys in Green, really interested in the 80s and 90s and looking at a few stories around that time. I just think it was such a pivotal time in Irish history, and that's kind of where the next story lies. And there's loads of other sports stories I'd love to do, and I think there's some amazing ones out there. I was dying to do one with the Irish women's soccer team. It didn't come to pass, unfortunately, but I just think that that team and those characters are an incredible bunch of people that people are waking up to. And hopefully are going to qualify for London in what is now 2022 for some inexplicable reason. Even though the tournament could go ahead, of course, the women's tournament gets bounced back. And I think there's lots of fascinating stories in women's sport, actually. And I think that, in a way, there's so many underdog stories there, like the whole, in some cases, the entire sports are underdog stories. And there's so much more going on in them sometimes than in some of the men's sports. There's a lot to be done there. And having done Katie, I'd love to find more stories that are in women's sport that can really transcend it and meet a good audience, you know. So you're always on the lookout for interesting stuff, I suppose.
Yeah, I think that struggle probably becomes interesting too. You know, it's not that long ago that the Irish women's rugby team had to pay for their own train in France to get to a match in the Six Nations. A few years later, they become Grand Slam champions. In the case of the women's soccer team, you know, having to give back their training equipment so that a boys' team can use them afterwards. That kind of struggle, I think, makes for an interesting narrative too.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, those are the struggles that you want to be able to tell the story of and actually should be told, you know. And I think as well, if you look at like someone like Katie McCabe, like what an unbelievable character. You know, she's obviously a gay woman who's out, who's proudly able to kind of light up the Aviva in rainbow colours around Pride. You know, that's a really brave thing to do. And she's quite a young woman. She's also excelling at Arsenal. She's a phenomenal footballer. That's just one character, you know. Someone like Louise Quinn, who has been through several clubs on her professional journey. Now she's going down to Florence, which I'd really definitely love to be doing the documentary so I could go to Florence. But, you know, so you have and obviously also a former title winner with Arsenal, Brianna going to Brighton, you know, yeah, just so many good stories. Denise Sullivan, you know, being basically the MVP in all US soccer. Like, I mean, they're incredible stories, even within that squad. And that's just one of the sports. And as you say, this was a team that was completely abandoned a few years ago and had to essentially almost go on strike. So, like, what a story that is. And I just think those stories are throughout women's sport of a struggle that men are, in many cases, are lucky enough not to have. And it's not really a case of taking anything away from men's sport. It's just a case of trying to elevate women's sport and to tell those stories and make people realize what incredible characters they are and how much they're achieving.
Well, if you do want to watch the AIB Toughest Summer, you can check it out. The episodes are on youtube.com/AIB. The first two episodes are live, David Brady and TJ Reid at this stage. A full-length feature documentary is coming your way at the end of next month. For more exclusive content and to see why AIB are back in club and county, you can follow AIB GA on Twitter, Instagram and on Facebook. Ross Whittaker, thanks a million for joining us and taking a break from the edit to have a chat to us here on Off the Ball.
Thanks for having me.
The OTB Podcast Network.